If you would like to work directly with Dr. Cole to maximize your sleep quality with a comprehensive sleep coaching program, or if you're concerned that you have sleep apnea, or simply just want a second opinion consultation, she's now available to see patients in New Jersey, New York, California, and Georgia, with more states coming soon. Please visit oak.care/sleep for a complete list of telemedicine services with transparent pricing. You deserve rapid access to quality sleep care with a physician you can trust to have your back every step of the way on your journey to better sleep.
Hi, I'm Dr. Allison Cole, sleep medicine specialist and bona fide chronic insomniac. Welcome to the Sleep is My Waking Passion podcast. Remember, knowledge is empowerment, and if applied correctly, it can help you biohack your way to a better night of sleep, just like I did. Hello, and welcome to the Sleep is My Waking Passion podcast. I am here with Dr. Jeff Dermer. He is someone that I connected with at CHEST 2023 in Hawaii, and we just hit it off. We started talking about all sorts of different things. Jeff was trained at UPenn. He is really, truly a neuroscientist. He is both an MD and a PhD. So I've got this like smarty pants that I get to talk to today. Jeff has led very interesting existence. He has been chief medical officer for a couple of companies now in the sleep space. Most recently, he was involved with Sleep Image, which is a home sleep testing company. He also has his own consulting company called Limbico Health, and he is a board member for the NIH. So you help kind of determine sleep disorder research, right? You're part of the advisory board.
Yeah. I don't tell them what kind of research to publish, but certainly I help with sort of framing the larger movements within the sleep and circadian neurobiology research realm, and also connecting what is it that this country needs from its research.
That's huge, because that conversation needs to happen. Otherwise, we can't really move forward if folks can't get funded and kind of push the envelope a bit. So it's really interesting to see that you're involved with that. But one of the things that we talked about was, and I'm kind of obsessed with it, so I keep bringing it up, but your experience training athletes. And what I mean by that is really helping them maximize their sleep. So I was hoping you could share with the audience a bit about how sleep may affect athletic performance and some of your experiences in assisting some Olympians and kind of optimizing their sleep for, you mentioned specifically for the Tokyo Olympics.
You mentioned Penn in the very beginning. So I haven't been back to Penn in over 17 years. I've basically spent most of my time in academics at Penn and also at Emory. And then after that started, as you mentioned, a couple of different companies outside of Emory. And those were really dedicated to bench to bedside, not just research, but also bench to bedside clinical care. And those programs exist to this day. One's called Fusion Sleep in the Atlanta area, does pediatric to adults and everything from dental to psychiatric care to typical sleep medicine care. But the bigger picture was, how do we implement technology into the space of sleep? And this was circa 2003, 2004, and took a lot of our research concepts developed for large population phenotyping. So I was doing phenotype genotype research when I was at Emory, looking at RLS in pediatrics and also in adults, the overlaps with iron deficiency in ADHD. And we had to characterize the sleep disorder movements, as well as the difficulties people were having during sleep that were not necessarily just sleep apnea or periodic limb movements, and developed some home-based, what we now call home-based testing devices, which before those studies, we really didn't have much. People were using pulse oximeters and things to look at apnea effects, but we didn't really have home sleep apnea testing. There was nothing FDA cleared. And so the company that I helped form actually had the first FDA cleared device. I didn't form Embla, but that was the company that we came out of and the Emblata. So that team actually became our team at Knox Medical and Knox Health, which was the next couple of companies that I helped to work and develop, so that we could actually use those tools that we did utilized in clinical research in the clinical care and management of large populations. So that's kind of where I came from. And so I've stayed in academics, but I actually have been working mainly in industry, and I continue to collaborate with all kinds of different colleagues still in academics to this day. That's still a big part of what I do. But the athletic aspects of what I do sort of go back to the beginning for me. I was always an athlete as a kid, played you know, three sports all year round. My parents kept me and my brother constantly busy. That led to going to college on different scholarships for athletics. I was a rower, so I rowed in college. And then afterwards, I was an elite U.S. rower for a few years before I decided that I needed to do something more cerebral, which led me to Penn as a medical student and as a PhD candidate. And during that time, as an elite rower, I found that there was really no real support for these non-professional sports and athletes. And it was very telling because there wasn't really a place to learn about all of the different aspects of performance, and they weren't really taught by anybody. And so I became very interested in the idea of performance. But I actually, in my research work with Dave Dinges and a few at Penn, really found that there were a lot of negative consequences to just simple sleep loss and sleep deprivation. And this was something that we didn't hear much about in medical school or even in grad school, except for the talks that Dave gave. And it was very intriguing to me because I was working in the brainstem of cats and animals doing neuroanatomy and neurophysiology of arousal and consciousness. And, you know, I wondered, the same circuits that I'm looking at also seem to be very important, the pedunculopontine nucleus, in things like rapid eye movement sleep. So there's daytime effects of the pedunculopontine nucleus in terms of writing and orienting, and then nighttime effects with rapid eye movement sleep. How do those connect? And so that became very intriguing to me. And that led to understanding more about the effects of things like REM sleep and non-REM sleep on your ability physically, your physical ability, but also your cognitive ability and learning. And that was sort of right around the era where we had a lot of fMRI research looking at the brain activity in humans that kind of correlated with some of the neurophysiologic studies that we have in animals associated with sleep deprivation. And lo and behold, there's some pretty similar issues that occur in human brains when they're sleep deprived. We're not even talking about quality issues. We're not talking about timing issues, just duration, amount of sleep you get. And so that was really telling to me. Then I started reflecting back on my days as an athlete. And I remember being incredibly in shape and, you know, very cognizant of what I did for my own performance, but I never really thought about sleep. In fact, I probably gave up so much extra sleep to work out that I was probably sleep deprived for a number of years, even before I became a physician.
Before medical school?
Yeah, even before medical school. But it was completely unintentional. So wind forward, I'm working at Emory. You know, after I left Penn, I was at Emory and worked with the sports folks because I worked in the executive program to help with executive performance and did those executive programs. And one of the orthopedic surgeons who was a friend of mine, Spiro Karas. Spiro was the team doc for the Falcons. And he said, Jeff, all the stuff that you published on and you told me about sleep is not a part of the current even professional football player mentality or the team. Wonder if that would be of interest for them. And so he kind of pulled me into those relationships and got us started using sleep principles, things like sleep banking and, you know, extension of your sleep window, and also how to mitigate travel effects using circadian timing and a number of other techniques that at that point were just sort of starting to emerge. Some of the work Terry Ma and others at the time at Stanford, and applied these as well as treated sleep apnea in a large population of the linemen in particular. It had a huge effect on their ability to recover, which I think was really telling to me because I thought, you know, they're going to feel better perhaps, but they're 20 somethings. They're 20, early 30s. So they're young people. They're very physically aware of themselves, but sleep itself was not something many were aware of. So just creating a lot of discussion as well as screening the entire team was sort of what I did at that point. And with the understanding I was trying to actually publish something because I was still very much an academic in that time. But it's hard to publish things with professional sports. they kind of want to keep things in their own corner. So we didn't publish anything, even though we had a great set of data showing the effects of improved sleep on outcomes that were physiologic outcomes, like direct physical outcomes that we could measure. But also the thing that the training staff mentioned was how quickly a lot of these guys could recover from a game. And if you think about a football game in the NFL, they're in a battle for an entire afternoon. And that battle actually leaves a lot of injuries, if not complete injury, just like aches and pains and arthritic types of symptoms. And it takes days to get over that. And oftentimes by Wednesday, moving on to Thursday, before a Sunday game is when they start to feel good enough to really start going at it. He said that they were actually recovering on Tuesday. They're feeling, you know, much, much more recovered. They were able to function and not feel as if they were suffering with a lot of different aches and pains that they typically would have responded. They would not have done well with. So I thought that was pretty touching.
And so when you think about what people talk about now and how the emphasis is on sleep, it seems to have evolved in part from that earlier work. And now we know a lot more. And even if you're not a professional athlete, I can definitely say they talk about the fact that you're less likely to be injured if you are getting sufficient sleep. And certainly I can attest to it's way easier when you're actually not completely sleep deprived to actually get a good workout in. Like you could actually focus on what you're doing. So it's probably multifactorial.
I think there's a lot of interrelationship here because there's new data that actually even suggests that if you're sleep deprived, you wake up after like a bad night of sleep or you didn't get enough sleep, a workout actually can be helpful in terms of stimulating wakefulness as well as making that performance during the day better. So I think there's evidence to suggest that there may be a bi-directional relationship between exercise and sleep. Certainly, we know that, you know, if you're exercising, just a normal non-athletic sort of elite person, if you're just exercise, it can improve depth of sleep. It can improve a number of different features of sleep. Less wake after sleep onset, a lot of issues with insomnia can actually be mitigated through exercise. And that's something that I think we've seen a lot of data around to support. So that's one direction. And the other is, of course, like you mentioned, the better your sleep and the more you can use your sleep to actually improve your performance, it actually adds to, there's some great data in like weightlifters who I work with the US Olympic team, that their physical, not just their physical, but their psychological sense of how much they're working is reduced when they get more sleep. So if you think about a weightlifter, their job is basically a one rep max. That's what they're trying to do.
Right.
Pick up the heaviest thing I can over my head. That is physically very demanding, absolutely. But even more so, it is psychologically demanding because just to take that huge weight, put it over your head and be okay with that time after time takes a lot of preparation mentally. So that mental preparation has a significant benefit when people are well rested, when weightlifters are sleep deprived, actually the physical act itself may not be as much impacted as the psychological act. So when they step up in front of that bar, it feels like harder work. It feels like I can't do this. So there's an actual psychological component, which actually may be even more important, especially at the elite level when we're talking about single pounds, kilos, making the difference.
But they're really big weights.
Yeah.
You know, these people are lifting really, really heavy.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
As a sort of reformed CrossFitter, if you will, I still really enjoy CrossFit, but just in focusing more on the weightlifting aspect of it as I've gotten older and having to be really careful with how you lift, you're spot on. So anybody who's listening who is into health, into fitness, into weights, just sort of start to pay attention when you're lifting because you will notice that almost like it feels sometimes when you're super tired and sleep deprived, like the littlest weight that normally would be nothing if you were in a good frame of mind may seem virtually impossible, you know, and you've really got to focus on technique too. There's a lot that goes into lifting safely for Olympic lifts, especially. Yeah.
Yeah, no, especially Olympic. It's so much a sport of quickness and timing. I mean, you're catching the weight, you're getting under the weight. There's all of this terminology that is not something that we typically would talk about when we're just going to the gym. So what they're doing with weights is a pretty remarkable feat, especially in an era where a lot of elite athletics is also sort of, let's say, penetrated by the use of illegal substances within the fields to improve performance. Weightlifting is one that it's actually had a very rocky sort of history, especially in a number of countries like Russia that have completely lost all fidelity. The teams are actually being treated with these drugs, these performance enhancing drugs. Countries are being thrown out. Actually, weightlifting is under the microscope right now at the Olympic level. In fact, at Paris this next year may be the last year if they don't get their act together because of this international issue. So one of the things that I talked to our team about, and actually have talked to other teams as well, I know the Canadians as well do a lot more in this than even we do, is using sleep as a performance enhancing opportunity that is not illegal. And
wow.
If you think about it that way, that's kind of what sleep is. Sleep is a performance enhancing component to your regime. If you're not using sleep, it actually becomes a real opportunity to now bring something in that's additional. And I have to say that there are a number of very high level athletes that I work with that have had a significant change just by adding different principles around how to improve duration, timing, and quality of sleep. But then also in a couple of cases, treating actual sleep disorders that were familial in nature. And they just thought were part of the natural order of sleep. My family doesn't sleep well, so that's the way it is. And lo and behold, restless leg syndrome is in the family, or lo and behold, sleep apnea, because they're all big bodies and there's a genetic propensity within the family for apnea in that in some cases, just like within the football players who are the big body lineman types. I've been impressed by the impact that it's had. I think the data around this has also been pretty impressive. It's just not been put together to my level of scrutiny to actually publish this data, because you really do need to be able to control certain aspects, which we can't really control in the natural environment very well. But they are a really important point. So we're starting to get the concept across within the elite population of athletes. And now it's actually filtering into the college level. The NCAA is taking this seriously. There are new statements by the NCAA very recently about the importance of sleep. Michael Graner and others have actually worked on a commission with the NCAA to get the sleep habits and sleep behaviors at least well understood, so that we're using naps in the middle of the midst of the circadian lull. We're extending sleep times appropriately. We're treating anxiety and insomnia symptoms in high-level athletes who are dealing with performance issues. These are all connected. So one of the people I work with the most actually is the sports psychologists or parts of the organizations, because a lot of the athletes will go to the sports psychologist now that that's kind of understood as a way to help yourself. But the sports psychologists are now like, Jeff, what do I do with this sleep issue? Like, send it over here. We have a connection now. We work back and forth. That works really nicely within the weightlifting team. And I'm starting to work with other teams as well, like the fencing team. And I work with swimmers and I work with rowers and continue to work with football players and CrossFitters. I've worked with elite CrossFitters and powerlifters as well, which has been really interesting. Now we're starting to rev up for Paris. So we did have a great outcome in Tokyo in 2020, which is actually 2021. But that year we put together a circadian training camp. I call it that because basically we flew everybody from the US to Honolulu for 2 weeks, which is 7 hours off of Japan. That way we could get them acclimated to a Japanese time zone 2 to 3 weeks before they actually had to perform. The benefit of that wasn't just that we could get them performing at a later time because they had a basically delay to go to Tokyo, but also we could start to actually manipulate their eating, manipulate their wake behaviors, and also really focus on extending sleep time, improving sleep efficiency, and using the sleep part of the camp as an important component that really drove the camp. So by the time athletes were leaving to go to Tokyo and they had to compete 2 or 3 days after they got to Tokyo, they were already adjusted to the time zone, but they'd also extended their sleep from an average of like 8.5 hours to like 9 hours, 9.5 hours. So they'd already added more sleep time, banking concept, and they already had adjusted. So when they hit the ground in Tokyo, their last lift in Honolulu was something like 12 midnight. So they were really close to 7 a.m. as a lift. And so they were able to land in Tokyo, get bright light in the morning. So we got them all there in the mornings, activated for the day, didn't really do a hard workout that day, just got them activated, got them food on the right schedule, and then got them physically active, just like running, light lifting, stretching, yoga, that kind of stuff. And then they would go into competition mode. But they were within a couple of days already on the right timeline. Their physiology had been adjusted and they'd already optimized their heaviest lifts towards the hours where they would actually be performing those lifts. We really tried hard to use that as a concept. And whether it had anything to do with the outcome, we did have a really good outcome in 2020. So we had silver medals. We had fourth places just off the podiums for a lot of the men's, which was amazing because we had men on this podium since 2000, actually, in Athens. This was a big change. And coming up in this next cycle, which is next year, 2024 in Paris, we're doubling down on this concept. And I'm working with each of the athletes to actually optimize where they are right now. Some are in Oregon, some are in Atlanta, some are New York State, some are in California, some in Florida, how to optimize their timing for these different events. So they're over in the Middle East right now. And so we had to get them adjusted to the Middle East. And next time they're going to have to adjust going to Paris. So, you know, we're working on all the different sleep issues. I'm testing them using the cardiopulmonary coupling, looking at sleep quality, not really sleep apnea, but sleep quality. And I actually treated a couple of them for sleep apnea using oral appliances. But the bigger issue is, are you timing your sleep properly? Are we seeing other aspects, like are we seeing sympathetic surges throughout the night that we need to address either psychologically or just through behavioral changes? So it's not so much medicine. It's actually more, as you said, neuroscience and applying it within a population for performance.
This is really exciting, though, because having done a lot of travel this year, and I normally kind of hate traveling, I started really paying attention to things like, what's the flight time? Do I need to adjust? I actually use something I call sort of a hack, if you will, but I thought it worked wonderfully, which is the Time Shifter app. I used that when I traveled over to Hawaii. It was funny. I was on the beach before the conference started and just sitting down listening, overhearing a conversation of someone's like, oh, he's really jet lagged, doesn't feel good. And I'm sitting there going, oh man, I did the right thing. I kind of followed the program and I'm feeling a lot better. So there are options for you if you don't have a Jeffderm in your life to optimize your sleep every time you travel. This is really exciting stuff. Can you explain a little bit to the audience just about cardiopulmonary coupling?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I did spend a bit of this past year working as the chief medical applications officer for Sleep Image, a company here in Denver where I live, helping them to broaden the message of their technology, which I think is quite impressive technology. It's actually over 20 years old in terms of the concept behind it. But what it is using the autonomic nervous system as a way to measure the effectiveness or quality of sleep. And the way this was initially sort of discovered at Harvard by Dr. Robert Thomas back sort of like right around the early 2000s was he was looking at EKG and the fluctuations in heart rate variability, as well as this fluctuation within the heart rate, within the EKG signal itself, which was the pulmonary signal. Because as you breathe in, increasing filling pressures, there's a pulmonary effect on the cardiac output. So from an EKG signal or photoplethysmography, just a PPG, which is often the pulse ox kind of thing, that can pick up the same variability in heart rate, which is easy to understand, but then also this variability in tidal volume. And he used these two variables that seem to be pretty easily tied to your system and looked at them during sleep versus wake. And you can see clear differentiation between wake, REM, non-REM 1, 2, 3, and 4 at the time. But actually looking at the non-REM, he found that it wasn't really about staging. It was about stability. So what you can see from the cardiac and the tidal volume signals in the CPC analysis is that when they correlate, or when they couple, as we call it, cardiopulmonary coupling, there's a mathematical formula. It's an algorithm. It's not like a black box AI thing or anything. It's just basically the coherence of those signals, which is a statistical concept of how one affects the other. How are they coherently related in time between zero and one, one being the highest correlation between the two. And then also the spectral overlap. So a typical fast Fourier transform would actually, you know, put everything into frequency bands, and you put the tidal volume and the heart rate variability signal into these two Fourier, and then you overlap them. How do they match up in terms of spectral density or power? And so that power analysis and the coherence analysis are used in a mathematical formula. It's pretty simple, squared plus. That actually comes up with a number between 0 and 100, or 0 and 1. And the lower the number, the less coupling, or they call it low frequency coupling. The higher the number, the higher frequency coupling. And what he found is that when there is high coupling of the cardiovascular, of the cardiopulmonary signal in the CPC analysis, that correlates directly with stable non-REM sleep. When delta waves are being created in the cortex, you're getting an output in the autonomic nervous system controlling the heart and the lungs that leads to stability. And when it's influenced by sympathetic surges, that could be due to insomnia, could be due to apnea, could be due to any different thing, you get low frequency outputs. And those low frequency outputs can be divided further into broadband, which means that they happen across a larger band of lower frequencies, or narrow band. And those narrow band actually correlate directly with periodicity in breathing patterns. And it found, he turned, you know, a number of research studies later, that actually correlates directly with central breathing patterns and central apnea, as well as chain Stokes respiration. So very sensitive technique using autonomic nervous system output to detect central breathing, as well as apnea. When you use the O2 signal together with these CPC, you can actually find sleep apnea, central and obstructive, as almost equal to polysomnography. It's that sensitive. And then also there's all these other measurements that are autonomic in nature, like fragmentation, cyclical variation in heart rate, which are very sensitive signals to sleep disruption, sympathetic surges in particular, but they're not specific. Unlike the apnea components, these are not specific. So they give a clinician or somebody who's using it for performance an indicator that I can say, hey, there's something happening here in this athlete's sleep. It's not apnea. They don't report restless leg syndrome. It might be something else that I can't tell just from this test, but there is something. So I investigate further and find, lo and behold, their behaviors are off, or they're having racing thoughts. They're waking up and, you know, having difficulty with sleep. So this is a test, an objective measurement of this autonomic nervous system output that's beyond sleep apnea or sleep disordered breathing that you can do longitudinally across night after night after night in the home environment. So the benefit of being in the home environment, we all know what that is compared to sleeping in a lab, but it's really much more about being able to see sort of a pre and post when you put an intervention into place, like if you put an oral appliance on, or if you bring in a medication, or you change a behavior, or you add CBTI. What's the effect on the actual physiology? Well, there's an objective measurement tool. And one other thing that I think is very important is that there's also something called a sleep quality index, which is an autonomic nervous system index that Sleep Image developed using the CPC with Dr. Thomas and other researchers. And they published this a number of different times, in fact, to the point where they got an FDA clearance for the only objective sleep metric. Pretty cool. It's called the Sleep Quality Index, and it takes the periodicity, that fragmentation metric of broadband, low frequency, and cyclical variation in heart rate, and actually uses that to build an index between 0 and 100 in terms of the effectiveness of your sleep. Not what apnea looks like, but what's the effectiveness of your overall sleep pattern that night. They have normative data for adults and kids. So if an adult is under 60, basically they're probably having issues with their sleep quality. For kids, it's a little higher, around 70. So those are things that can be used just by themselves, or you can use that SQI number, that index, for the individual pre and post therapy. And I found that to be really effective. Like if I treat somebody for sleep disordered breathing, it's pretty, you know, pretty clear that's what I'm looking at. So I put this device, they just wear it on their finger, and they basically can use it for a number of days. And one of the things we often see, you know, people using CPAP for the first time, uncomfortable, only a few hours, I take it off. It's not great. It takes time for them to acclimate to the actual device. You can see that in sleep quality index. Like the apnea index, the AHI will go down, but the sleep quality will not improve. So that takes time. As the AHI continues to stay where it needs to be, all of a sudden you start to see the SQI climbing day after day after they've acclimated. So you can kind of use it as a baseline, as an objective way to measure difficulty with somebody getting used to a therapy. And then how do they adjust? Do I have to add a new therapy? Do I have to add a medication in to help reduce arousal for those with heightened arousal threshold or lower arousal thresholds? Or are they having centrals when you put them on a device? Are they having these new sort of CPAP emergent central apneas? I can see that. Plus I can see the lack of improvement in their sleep quality. That's what that's about. That's what the CPC
wow.
does.
Wow. So guys, in a nutshell, we're using a lot of terms that may seem like, oh, what are this mumbo jumbo that they're talking about? But the reason I was particularly intrigued with speaking with Jeff is because I believe that this is really sort of where we're going to go in the future. A lot of our standard sleep testing, and if you talk to a sleep specialist, may comment on, okay, well, how many times did I stop breathing? Did I have a certain criteria of a drop in oxygen level, which is debated if you're Medicare or non-Medicare, and there's other factors that go into how we interpret some of this stuff. But that's sort of like what we tease out. We get information about heart rate and we can see things like, okay, as you're starting to recover from apnea, we may see a change and we can see where there's blips of what we call arousals from sleep. And we can calculate things like, well, how many arousals did you have per hour? But this is what Jeff is describing is really taking it to the next level. When we talk about tidal volume, what we're saying is routine breathing. As I sit here and I'm listening to Jeff speak, for example, that's my tidal volume. It's your just kind of your general air movement. You're not taking big breaths. It's sort of your baseline amount of movement of air, if you will. And then your heart rate will vary with that. And as he mentioned, the signals will change because you're basically changing the pressure inside your thoracic cavity, your chest. And so there's pressure changes that occur. And so that affects how the heart functions. So it's fascinating to me how you're applying this. I'm particularly interested in the sleep quality. And as I mentioned to you, one of the things I'd like to start doing in my clinical practice is really trying to incorporate this to really tease out, have I really improved this person's sleep quality? Because a lot of times, sometimes you think, okay, well, I've checked the box. They have sleep apnea. I've put them on a machine. They're all better now. But that might not be the case. And we definitely have, over the years, if you treat a lot of sleep patients, you see folks that are like, yeah, I'm on CPAP, but I don't really notice that much of a difference, or I don't really notice, you know, that much improvement in the quality of my sleep. I'm sort of just using it because my bed partner likes that I don't snore. I think there's a lot of application here, regardless of whether or not you have a particular sleep disorder or not. Just like you're saying, you are really trying to optimize athlete sleep. And this may be useful for clinicians to start using with their patients as well.
This has been such a cool discussion on sleep and athletic performance. So thank you very much for sharing your expertise with the world. If you have not left this podcast truly understanding just how significant lack of sleep will impact your athletic performance, listen to it again. And you know that you will benefit from a good quality of sleep, and you don't have to be an elite athlete for that effect to take place. So please, please, please prioritize your sleep and stick around, because next week, Jeff and I are continuing our discussion and we're going to move to the topic of restless leg syndrome. And it's really going to be very eye-opening for you. So I hope you enjoy this and listen. Hello to all my fellow sleep biohackers out there. I have a call to action for you. If you are enjoying this podcast, if you feel that you are growing, you're more knowledgeable, you're feeling empowered about your sleep, that is the purpose. So please, please take the time to like and review the podcast, share it amongst your friends and family. Please follow me. If you'd like to follow me on Instagram or Facebook, I am there as well. My handle on Instagram and TikTok is AskTheSleepMD. And you can also go to my website, AskTheSleepMD.com, for more information about each of these episodes. We will be sharing with you cited articles that you can actually refer to and read yourself if you like, and lots of juicy tidbits about how to sleep better. Thank you. This podcast is made possible with the exquisite talents of Mr. Joey Salvia, my producer, Mr. Adrian Pederath, my creative director, and music by Lori Kunzel of KunzelMusic.com. Disclaimer: the statements made on this podcast have not been evaluated by the U.S. Food or Drug Administration. They are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent disease. The information provided by this podcast should not be used as individual medical advice. While I am a practicing sleep provider, I am not your sleep provider. You should always consult with your personal healthcare provider for individual recommendations and treatment.